Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Goslin, Dialect's Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust in 2002. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com. This week, GRC bailiffs advertise themselves as such. They're on Park Road, but they don't bother going to court before they evict you. We speak to James, who was thrown out on the street a couple of weeks ago by them. And Hubert Sadej is Polish. He was arrested last week, put in handcuffs, and is about to be deported to Poland for having no money. Also, Charles Shee. He got sacked for blowing the whistle on fake parts for Boeing 737 jets. And Benji Beer speaks to Dialect's Imogen Sawatka about student suicide. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk. And if you want to join in, contact the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, and I'll give you contact details at the end of the show. Well, I'm joined on the line now by James, who's been the subject of some rather nasty eviction procedures. Now, James, I know you're homeless. Can you tell us a bit about your situation?
Basically been squatting in Bristol for the last 2 years now. It really kind of began with me when I wasn't entitled to housing assistance from the council. So obviously you have to go down the DIY route from there. So hence that's why I was put in that position.
Let's just have a look at that for a minute, because you are homeless. Surely you are entitled to, or wherever you were, if you haven't got enough income, you're entitled to housing benefit. What happened?
Well, where it all started was when I returned from Germany, because I've done a stint over in Germany for about 6 months. I came back to the UK. One of the first things I did was go down to the benefit office to put in a claim for job seekers allowance. And they said, well, we see here you've been out of the country for over 6 months, therefore you're not entitled to any benefit for 3 months. So making not being able to claim benefit obviously makes getting housing entitlement quite complicated. Hence, that's why I started squatting and went down the DIY route.
Yeah, so tell us about, you know, finding your first squat. How did you do that?
Got in contact with BAM, and they kind of put me in the right direction towards getting buildings and things like that. Started out with a building down Old Market. It started out with me and a couple of friends of mine, an old warehouse, and we were there for about 7 months. That was the first one.
Yeah, so, I mean, how did you survive that? I mean, you've got to do things like, obviously, you need water, you need electricity, things like that. Did you manage to get all those?
They had electric there. Water we were using from a tap around the corner. We got in, you know, cleaned the entire place up, built our own kitchen in there, built toilet facilities and things like that. We moved a load of furniture, stuff that was donated to us, stuff we kind of found on the street. Sort of just tried to be as innovative and resourceful as possible, and we got it going to a nice little setup.
So how come the place was empty?
That place was owned by a company called Harmonsworth Pension Fund. It had been, I think, derelict for several years. I think they were kind of in, it was somehow tied in with the Bristol Post. I'm not too sure. It was quite an old warehouse, but it had been derelict for several years. I just don't think they were using it anymore. Took us till about September for Harmonsworth Pension Fund to actually find out we were there. They then, about another 3 or 4 months later, they issued court proceedings, which, of course, we couldn't really contest because at the end of the day, they have the deeds to the building, we don't. It's as simple as that.
Yeah. It's interesting, isn't it? I mean, so the pension fund owned it from the Daily Mail empire, but it does sound as if a lot of these buildings are being used almost like as an investment for speculators.
Exactly. I mean, particularly around the old area, around the old market area, of course, because the building may not be much, but, you know, that particular block, Harmonsworth Pension Fund, that owns several buildings around there. It just is, in the day, valuable building land that can be sold on for like over £1 million. And, of course, as we know, that area is due for a lot of redevelopment with luxury flats and whatnot.
Okay, so anyway, so more recently you've had a bit of trouble with bailiffs, haven't you? The normal procedure is that if you're squatting somewhere, I mean, it's interesting that you can be there for nearly a year, well, something like up to a year before the owners even know you're there, which does show that for a lot of people who are desperate for somewhere to live, it's rather galling that people have these massive properties that they simply don't use, that are just simply sitting there like money in the bank. I mean, the first lesson from that has got to be use it or lose it. I don't think that people should be able to keep buildings like that, that they are actually actively stopping people using.
Also, the other thing I'd say is that what I've learned, if a building's actually maintained and kept and not lived in, it actually decays very quickly. Now, buildings like this, they will just decay and become a complete blight on the local landscape. You know, you have like a load of derelict buildings around there, they can get vandalised, it can attract local crime, which can have a detrimental effect for the rest of the neighbourhood. I mean, the thing is, if you do have a decent set of squatters in that can actually maintain that building, they do actually keep it in good order.
So anyway, you've had some problems recently, I know, with bailiffs, but you see, the normal procedure is the owner will take you to court, as you say, produce
that's
the deeds in court, then they get a possession order, and you get a certain amount of time, sometimes it's less, sometimes more, to vacate the premises before the bailiffs turn up. But I understand that you've been subject to a procedure which is actually completely outside the court.
That's right, yeah. It happened recently in the site having fish ponds.
So how can some bailiffs arrive when there hasn't been any kind of court proceedings?
Well, in this case, what happened was the owner turned up at this building. I won't actually say the company owner at the moment. He was declined to communicate with us at all, got straight on the phone to his lawyer. Again, this building had been derelict for around about 3-4 years. It was the one in Fishponds which they actually wanted to turn into a McDonald's drive-through. There had been a lot of strong local opposition towards this. They'd had their application turned down, but they put in for an appeal. So the next thing we know, at 4:45 in the morning, it was on Tuesday the 18th of May, if I remember correctly, got awoken up by a big commotion outside. There were actually 8 guys outside all wearing balaclavas and who were also armed with batons and CS spray trying to smash their way in for the double glazing door at the front. At this point, I got the phone to the police straight away, made a 999 call and said, you know, there are persons here who are trying to break in. And they said, yep, send the car around straight away. I then kept in contact on that 999 call. These guys then realised they weren't going to get in through the front, so they then tried to get in back. They managed to force their way in through a gap around the back. 2 guys jumped in, which I then demanded they actually identify themselves because they hadn't. They never said they were bailiffs. They never said this is an eviction. Even their insignia wasn't particularly well displayed. And I asked them, I said, are you GRC? Now, the first communication that we actually have with these guys is the one guy basically says, get out, get the out. That's what they, you know, the first thing they said. In fact, one of the bailiffs was in such an agitated state that one of the occupiers actually had to say to him, look, mate, you need to calm down, start taking deep breaths. They then said, you know, you've got to get out of here. The guy that appeared to be the boss, I asked him if he had a court order. He said, yeah, we've got one. I said, can I see it? And he said, I slipped up my body armour on the way in here. And so afterwards, we did actually find a document that had been left on the ground, but it was not a legal document. Now, the police did actually turn up outside, but they did appear to be quite apathetic about the situation. So these guys basically forced entry.
So hang on a minute. Let's just stop a second, because you have you're lawfully in possession of that building as a squatter. You have a legal right to use that building. And you call the police, someone's trying to break in. Those people, how did they persuade the police that they had a right to break in?
Well, I mean, by the time the police got in there, they were already in. I think one car first turned up with 2 officers there. They then went away and a whole van load turned up. Now, I was actually inside the building at the time, kind of getting packed up and this sort of stuff, but the police just stood on and viewed the whole proceedings. They weren't interested in getting involved.
So what do you put this down to? I mean, what was their, did they have a legal right to do what they did? Were the police right to stand aside?
I don't believe they did. The police never taught us. You know, I asked the guy for the court order. He failed to show one. I don't believe they actually did have a court order. I believe the police should have asked them to see the paperwork. I don't believe they did. So in this case, it was an illegal eviction. And, you know, the police, I vote for the police acted adequately.
Okay, so, you know, the any idea who these GRC bailiffs are?
This is the third time that I know if they've done this in the Bristol area in the past 6 months. I do know they're registered locally. The guys that were there are all Welsh. I believe they're from around the Cardiff area.
Now, this is the sort of thing that you do sometimes get with traveller evictions from land. But as far as we know, is this the first time this has happened in Bristol?
Right. This is actually, the third time this has happened in Bristol in the space of about 6 months. It's happened twice before in St. Philip's. Basically the same thing again. You know, these guys do turn up in the early hours of the morning, smash their way in, fail to produce a court order. The police have been called, but they don't seem to want to get involved in it. And, yeah.
So have you any idea what the legal basis for this is? I mean, what have they said to you? They must have said something.
Right. Now, according to GRC's website, which I've had a look at, they said one thing they do deal in with squatter evictions, and according to them, they said that they can do it without the need for a lengthy and costly court case. To the best of my knowledge, I believe that in a squat, you always do have to go to court, has to take you to court, and an eviction can't go ahead unless there is an actual court order. So this quote from GRC, they can do a squatter eviction without a court order. I don't understand where they're getting this from.
And what about the police? Have you had any sign from them that this is illegal? Because it certainly seems to be. If you haven't actually been to court to prove you own a property, it seems incredible that you're allowed to break into one.
Yeah, what I did do was after that, I did actually put an official complaint to Avon Somerset Police. Got an email back from them that afternoon saying, this is a civil matter. If you're not happy with a bailiff company's conduct, you need to contact them directly. I then retorted to that email and say, I'm sorry, forcing your way into a building without a court order is illegal. I also believe that, you know, being in possession of batons and CS spray does constitute carrying an offensive weapon.
Yeah, it does sound like, you know, you'd be quite within your rights reporting it as a crime to be investigated by the police. And what's been their attitude?
The last email that I got was just a kind of standard generic email saying this is a civil matter. You know, if you're unhappy with their conduct, you have to go to them directly.
Now, it does seem like this might be encouraging the behaviour of violent thugs without actually bothering to go through the courts to get what they want. So where do you think this is heading?
I personally don't think this will be the last time that GRC operate in Bristol. I believe it could happen again. You know, and the thing is, by doing what they're doing, not only are they putting themselves at risk, they're also putting other people at risk. Because that morning, if they hadn't have been able to get for the back, they did come equipped with a ladder, and I believe their plan C was to go come smashing through an asbestos roof. Which, as I've already said, would have put us and themselves in quite a bit of danger.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it, that the Daily Mail and similar news outlets portray squatters as the people who are coming into people who are living in their homes and taking away their domestic homes, whereas actually it looks like the opposite is true, that you've got paid thugs coming in posing as bailiffs. Are these people registered in any way in any official capacity?
Okay, they state that they're appointed by the courts. That's what they state. Now, I will also stress at this point, these guys never actually showed any official ID badges. I would obviously thought they would have to be, you know, licensed by the Security Association and also appointed by the courts. It says on the website they've got all their good stuff, but I personally don't know if they actually are.
Okay, well, I hope James, that you can keep in touch with us and let us know if you come across any more of the activities of GRC bailiffs in Park Row. The temptation here is to think that, well, landlords that just want a cheap eviction, don't want to bother with going to court and just want a crew of vigilantes will be calling them.
That's it. No, it does seem worrying, you know, if this could well escalate. And also, I think with these guys is, you know, kind of weird that actually didn't know who they were that morning. We just thought it was literally a gang like with thugs. There could come a time where, say, one of the persons in the building actually decides to go and arm themselves again. It's putting both parties at risk.
Okay, James, I thank you very much for joining us on Dialect.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
My name is Hubert Sadat. I've been born in 30th March 1982. I'm 35 years old. Been in England for around 12, 13 years. I basically came into the United Kingdom in 2005. Straight away, I started legal work for the past 12 years. I got 10 years ongoing contributions, paid national insurance and all the taxes. And right now, I'm being held in the detention center and being subject to removal from United Kingdom, regardless of statutory rights, after 5 years of continued residency. I should gain a status of resident. Right now, they're treating me like a criminal.
So what reason have the immigration office given you for saying that you have to leave?
Yeah, the only accusation towards me is rough sleeping, basically. And they claiming I'm not working, I'm contracted with one of the Bristol's work agencies and currently trying just to get back on my feet after my marriage broke and I spent some time on the street and just trying to lift myself up. And, rough sleeping is the reason, actually.
Now, I mean, a lot of people will be surprised to hear that that we haven't had... We got 2 years before Brexit. And to hear that someone from the European Union is actually being deported just simply for having no money, that surely is an offence. What have they explained to you? Why?
No, the rough sleeping is the major reason, you know. That's what I get on my paperwork from the Home Office. I spoke to them several times and told them the same thing, that I've been staying here for 12 years. For 10 years, I contributed to the taxes and everything. I've been having legal jobs. Then my life after my marriage broke went a little bit downwards, but I never let myself down to this point and always tried to get back on my feet. Right now, I'm not really sure if that will be possible, as I'm being subject to be deported.
Well, I know. And also, of course, if you're homeless, it's very difficult to get back into work. I mean, have you been offered anywhere to live? Have there been any help with finding you somewhere to live?
Yeah, they offered one of the agencies, which is Compass Centre in Bristol, offered me a place in a hostel, but spending some time in Bristol, past 10 years actually in Bristol, I've been meeting several people living in those hostels, and they said the situation in the hostels is horrid and the places are not secure, so I didn't opt for that. I rather stayed outside in the tent than getting between different kinds of addictive personalities, you know.
Yeah, so it doesn't sound to me as if the hostel is a very good place for someone who's homeless necessarily.
No, it's definitely not. I've been using a few times help from charity organizations and several Christian organizations, as well as the Methodist centers, and the sort of people which I'm meeting there are definitely people not of my kind, you know. I wouldn't like to associate with this kind of environment. Obviously, I used the help, but quite selectively. I didn't make any ties with any of those people.
Are you saying that that you found the Christian people difficult?
No. The Christian people are right. I'm saying the people which using those hostels and those kinds of helps, they, I would say, people with the bad habits, people after prisons, you know. I never been to prison and all that stuff. So going to a hostel, I wouldn't feel safe.
Also, can you just describe what it was like to be arrested, I mean, and detained? What happened?
Oh, basically, I was staying in our encampment where I'm staying with few of my friends. And at 6:50 in the morning, immigration police with the representative of council as well as regular PCs, they came down and handcuffed me like a proper criminal, you know. I told them the handcuffs are basically hurting my hands, and this guy just said, no, no worries, it's just to the van, you know. And I said, but why I'm in handcuffs? I never done anything bad to anybody. They were reluctant to actually even loosen my handcuffs. What about to take them off, you know? And then I've been transported together with my friend, which was staying in our place for the night at the time, just visiting us. We've been detained to the Patchway police station. We're being held 12 hours with not much of an explanation. The funniest thing, when I asked them how long they will keep me there for, the guy just responded to me, oh, we can keep you here forever, mate. So I was quite shocked at this time. I never was detained in such a confined space for such a long period of time with no explanation, you know. That was a really hard time for me. So afterwards,
No, you carry on.
Yeah, afterwards we've been transported to the van, to the old prison, which is now the detention center, where I've been presented the paperwork on Saturday. I've been presented the paperwork, which was saying that on this coming Friday, which is day after tomorrow, I will be deported back to Poland for rough sleeping. On Monday, I tried to acquire a visit with solicitor. Visit with solicitor is booked for me on Monday, which is already after deportation date. So it's breaching even my basic right to defend myself, to do whatever in that situation.
What about the other people? There were two more people detained with you, weren't there?
Yes. One of my friends, Sebastian, which is staying in our camp, he was actually shortly released from the Patchway station. I don't know the circumstances because we were held further down, and since then I haven't seen him. Another friend, which was staying overnight and just visiting us, is here with me in the detention center, which is quite silly because he's having fixed address. He's living at home regularly with his missus, and he's working and all that stuff, you know. So he's been held here with me with no reason whatsoever. They didn't even spoke to him, giving him any reasons for being held over here, and it's over a week now.
So tell us about him. What's his situation?
Oh, his situation is still waiting for anything, really, because he's been having an interview, and they didn't present him with any accusations whatsoever, no information whatsoever for him, how long he's going to be, and what's going to be here for him. No.
And does he have... Does he have dependents here in Britain, or friends or family at all?
Yeah. He's living with his missus in Bristol, you know, and he's having normal home address and regular work. And he's, regardless of that, he obviously stated all that in several interviews, but regardless of that, he's still not being presented with any accusations or reasons of being held here, you know.
Amazing. Absolutely shocking to see that this kind of thing can happen. Yeah, so what can you do now in this situation?
Oh, in this situation, I'm just going to refuse to leave this place, you know, because they want to basically transport me to the Gatwick Airport and then send me with the nearest plane back home. Also, I'm being subject to being banned from re-entering United Kingdom for next 10 years.
So, well, I mean, what would you say to people that would say, well, actually, if you're Polish and you're in Britain and you haven't got a job and you're just living in a tent, then maybe you shouldn't be here?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I would say to them, this life and this planet will be given for free to human race, you know. I was given my life by my mother, and no one ever told me I have to pay for it. And I think it's horrid someone tried to force us to really comply with the standards which we don't really want to agree, but breaching basic rights of human rights to freedom, you know, like for me. Because as a European Union national holding valid document like passport, it's United Kingdom agreement on the European national laws that we have freedom of movement around the country and countries.
But I mean, the lawyers will probably say, "Well, you have violated the treaty rights." I think this is the Treaty of Rome, isn't it? That you know.
Yeah. They could say that if I wouldn't be spending here 10 years paying contributions, because regarding those treaty rights, there is also right to claim residential status after 5 years of staying here and paying taxes and contributing, you know.
So what does it make you think about the British system and the British justice? Does it make you really want to stay in Britain with these kinds of laws?
I really want to stay in Britain, you know. I understand it's just bureaucracy, you know. I understand it's bureaucracy, and like for me, all those people, they don't have any idea what they're doing. They try to do whatever and hoping that it will have an effect.
Why do you think they want to get rid of you?
I don't think personally anyone in this country trying to get rid of me, you know, that's the point. I don't blame any of the Home Office workers or any of the prison wardens which are servicing us here. I don't blame any of particular human beings for me being here, you know. It's just pure bureaucracy which holding us here, you know. Because I'm not being given the right to defend myself, to respond to all those accusations, you know. I'm being held in custody and removed forcefully right now.
So what's it like at the Verne?
It's quite all right, you know. We're having freedoms, like you can speak with me on the phone right now. The Verne is all right, the people over here fine. And then basically I heard other detention centers are being serviced by security companies. Regarding this one, it used to be a prison. We have normal prison guards over here, but they have been very polite and helpful. They understand we're not being criminals. We got 3 hot meals a day. We got use of facilities like a gym, music rooms. We can earn money, which is around £30 per week, for attending works in different workshops, bricklaying, wood mill, like I said, music, art. So basically not much of the laws are being breached inside, apart from the law of freedom, you know.
So do you think if you get deported back to Poland, do you think we'll see you back in Bristol again?
Oh, definitely. I'm not going to give up. Definitely I'll be back this way or another, you know, if I will be deported, because I haven't been deported yet.
That's right. Hubert, look, if you do manage to get back to Bristol, I'll be very pleased to welcome you in the studio rather than just talk to you on the phone.
Yeah, I do believe that. And if I will be back in Bristol, which I do believe I will, then definitely we'll meet you again and we speak some more about the topic, how was the ordeal afterwards.
Okay, you might have to come back by submarine.
No, I know the way already, guys. Guys at the veranda, the detainees, they already told me the way to come back.
Okay.
I won't be telling that in the interview.
No, okay, fair enough.
When I come back.
All right, Hubert, look forward to speaking to you soon.
And same from this side, sir.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Have a good evening.
Cheers, Hubert. Thanks.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
My name is Charles Shi. I worked for Moog Aircraft Group since 2006 until 2016, last year. When I was wrongfully terminated by whistleblowing to Moog top management and to FAA on the extraordinary aircraft safety threat.
Now, what was your job at Moog?
I worked as the East Asian supply chain manager for the aircraft group of Moog.
And what is MOG? For people who haven't heard of it, what is MOG? Does it produce aircraft itself?
Yeah, MOG is a U.S. company, New York Stock Exchange listed company. MOG has five business divisions. I worked for the aircraft group. And MOG is actually the world leader in the flight control systems. MOG is the manufacturer and the integrator for the flight control systems for both military and commercial.
Well, now, when you say a flight control systems, for many people, they'll think that means maybe like the rudders. That is to say, the thing that on the edge of the wings and on the tailplane. So what is a flight control system in the modern world? So I know there's a lot more electronics in the modern planes.
Yeah, I think, Tony, you just said right. Yeah, actually, the flight control system, so we define MOG as, from the head to tail, meaning from the cabin control, the control systems, the electronics to the wings and also the rudder and the stabilizers. Anything moves on the wings and the rudder that controlled by MOG actuation systems.
Now, I mean, in the old days, of course, there was a wire, an actual piece of steel wire went out to control the ailerons. Nowadays, it's electronic wires. What happens if you've got a power failure?
Oh, that's a disastrous. But nowadays, the airplanes has lots of redundancies. That means has a lot of systems, standby systems. One electrical system just went off. There are redundant ones. So normally we don't hear the power failure resulting the airplane to crash.
Okay, look, I'm going to play devil's advocate here. What about something like lightning hitting an aircraft? Surely that could, even though maybe a steel wire would survive a lightning strike, surely electronic wires are going to be fried and burnt, and it may mean that the pilot simply cannot control the plane.
Right. I think that's in the past. But nowadays, you see, I worked also for 1 year as program manager for the Chinese big aircraft program called the C919. So when I was in that position, I learned a lot of the aircraft, safety, designs like lightning. So the present day airplanes, so they have this risks already, analyzed and covered. There are technical means to remove those risks. I think we don't hear, Boeing airplanes, Airbus airplanes are struck by lightning, causing the airplane to crash. But
now, yeah,
there might be extreme situations that caused the airplanes to crash by lightning.
What about, what about testing? Do you and have you been involved in MOOG in actually deliberately, for example, flying aircraft into electric storms to see if they can survive them?
No, I was not involved in that testing. I did not go that far. But MOOG did have a laboratory doing something like that, testing a bird strike, lightning, and also mechanical failures. And MOG also, design and manufacture the testing equipment for Boeing, for other competitors like Parker Aerospace, Honeywell, probably GE and MOG.
You blew the whistle on some practices that you didn't agree with on aircraft safety. Now, first of all, we all know aircraft safety is supposed to be number one. Certainly the pilots are very, very good at sharing information with each other about potential hazards. But this was something where you felt you had to blow the whistle because otherwise people wouldn't have known. So what was the whole situation? When did you first realize something was wrong?
I think it came to my attention in 2015. We had a new Chinese supplier named Suzhou New Hongji Precision Part Company Limited, who was introduced by my then supervisor, who is a Chinese American. He was his name is Zhou Zhou. He was hired by Moog in 2013.
Okay, Joe, J-O-E-Z-O-U.
He just, introduced that privately owned small company into a Moog aircraft supplier approved list. He promoted very hard on that supplier, but from I think late 2013, okay, but in April 2015, I got some tips from my subordinates, two of them. They alerted me that this supplier, NHJ, we call NHJ, New Hongji, we short name them NHJ. They said their previous aerospace customer, BE Aerospace, exited from them. I asked why. My people told me they used substitute material for BE Aerospace. And BE found out in their laboratory when their products were being tested. So BE is a manufacturer of airplane seating systems or kitchen wares. So BE just exited from that supplier before Moog even had that supplier added into Moog supply base. So that is one critical point. So when I learned this, I immediately reported to Joe. I went to his office. I said, Joe, we had a situation that I heard that Liu Hongji was exited from BE. He said, yeah, I know that. So it's a raw material vendor screwed up. That's it. Then he just brushed off this thing. From that point, so I was cautious, very cautious, and nervous. And I instructed my people, one of them is the supplier development engineer, SDE. His job, the name, I cannot disclose his name, but let's see, S guy, okay? The S guy, we call SDE, reporting to me directly. He is the responsible person on that NHJ supply. He worked in that company on a daily basis because that company is new. So we assigned this S guy to manage that supplier on the supply development. You see, everything. So he reported to me a lot of issues, and I went myself to NHG a lot of times. Also, I observed many irregularities, but we don't have a proof that that supplier is using substitute or bad material, counterfeit material for Moog part. Aluminum and steel, many of them are safety sensitive or safety critical.
Okay, so what part of the aircraft were these parts? Where were they being used in the aircraft?
Okay, so the parts we gave to that supplier mainly for the flight control systems, hydraulic flight control systems on the wings. Among these 30 plus part numbers, one of them is a single point of failure part for B's Boeing 737 spoiler. So let me see, the spoiler is the actuation system to control the flaps when the airplane take off and land, to reduce the wind and to reduce the speed to make sure the airplane lands safely. So when we take the flight, we see from the window when the airplane take off, there are flaps on wings each side. They suddenly erect, or when the airplane land, the flames erupts suddenly to reduce the speed. That is the controlled by the spoilers. So that is very safety critical and safety sensitive. That single point of failure part for Boeing 737 spoiler is a steel part. This supplier was caught falsifying material certification while they use substituted material during my investigation.
Now, one of the key people in this is Claire Stadek. She's British, you say?
Yes. She's a British. She used to work one of the Moog facility in Wolverhampton, UK. My motivation, you know, to whistleblower, to Moog, to FAA, and to now disclosing this, you know, extraordinary, you know, aircraft safety threat to public. Because, you know, maybe Moog people, they don't fly the airplanes. They know there is threat, a safety threat. FAA officials, they don't fly this Boeing 737. They can fly, you know, Airbus 320, okay? But general public, we don't even know, you know, airplanes we are sitting that might have this single point of failure parts controlling the airplane when they take off and land. So according to, you know, U.S. authoritative, you know, agencies, 90% of airplane crashes happened during takeoff and landing. And the single point of failure parts are controlling landing and takeoff.
These Boeing 737s, what airlines are using them and how many aircraft are out there, do you think?
There are between 300 to 500 airplanes, Boeing 737 affected. You see, NHJ was the single source for that part since early 2015 till even today. So at least 300 and 500 airplanes, 737 affected. This data is on the Boeing website. You know, Boeing has the website of their sales, each airplane model and which customer bought. So in 2006, Boeing sold more than 600 737 airplanes. 19 of them, they sold to U.S. Navy. So you see this violation not just affect normal citizens, they affect U.S. military as well.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Our next discussion tackles the difficult topic of the increasing number of suicides taking place in the student community, a number of which have involved students at the University of Bristol. As young minds appear to be under mounting pressure, ONS figures have revealed that the number of deaths by suicide among students in England and Wales alone has risen over 50% in the last 10 years. At the same time, universities across the UK are facing a 50% rise in demand for their mental health services, as students present more and more frequently with higher levels of stress and anxiety. Closer to home, there have been reports of 5 suspected suicides involving students at the University of Bristol in only 6 months. The university has now signed the Time to Change pledge to help reduce the stigma of discussing mental health issues. It has also increased staffing levels in its support for students in each academic school. I'm joined by third-year Bristol University student Benji Beer. A few months ago, his close friend committed suicide and he has since campaigned on the importance of mental health at university. Hi, Benji.
Hi there.
Could you talk about the pressures that students are under today and the ways in which these pressures might be affecting students' mental health?
Yeah, sure. Well, the thing with the mental health crisis, which is what I believe it is, I think it is a crisis, is that it is incredibly complicated and multifaceted, and there are lots of different levels and lots of different factors that feed into why it might be happening. With students, you have all the normal issues that are affecting the rest of society, plus the fact that you are at an age at which you are being put under pressure to make life choices, in which you look at the world after university and you see that it's incredibly competitive, particularly if you want to go into things like finance and corporate work, which a lot of Bristol University students definitely do. And you wonder if you can survive. Mm-hmm. You wonder if you're good enough. you quite often, as a result of that, you'll think that you're not good enough. And then you wonder, even if I do succeed, is it the life, the kind of life that I want? Is it the kind of job that I want? Will working hours be terrible? Will I be worked off my feet? Will I enjoy what I do? There's a tremendous amount of anxiety about the future in particular, which I think students suffer from.
And would you say that there's also a lack of hope about the future as well?
Yes, I think with our generation in particular, the future seems really, really pretty bleak. Mm-hmm. Even if you are actually from a high-income background, a lot of people end up falling into the trap of feeling as if there is simply no point to living this kind of life that they've been offered.
Yeah. A pretty bleak picture. Mm. Would you say that the pressures that students are facing are steadily increasing, as opposed to what they were like about 10 years ago?
Yes, definitely. Mm-hmm. A large part of that is to do with the graduate jobs market, which is just rubbish. It's also to do with the kind of employment that's available. Increasingly, we seem to be being told that the only kind of employment you can really do, or that's worth doing, is corporate stuff.
Yeah,
I know a lot of people, a lot of fellow students who feel that way.
Mm-hmm. It's almost the pressure to be good enough has become overwhelming.
Yeah, absolutely.
We're expected to do more and more all the time.
Constant self-evaluation, mm-hmm. I think, is what comes out of that. So people get really, really sucked into these manic cycles of working extremely hard to get a first. And spending silly hours in the library, drinking far too much caffeine. Taking study drugs is a big, big issue that's arisen in the last 10 years as well. Because there's this immense emphasis on productivity. You've got to be as productive as you can possibly be, and that's how you measure your self-worth.
Yeah.
So if you put in 9 hours in the library, you're not as good as someone who's put in 10.
Yeah.
And it comes down to this kind of American Psycho-style frustrated self-evaluation in which everything is measured by productivity. I mean, if you remember, I don't know if you've seen American Psycho, but there's a famous scene where they introduce Patrick Bateman, who is the psycho financier who works on Wall Street, and he tells you about how his morning routine, and he does 1,000 sit-ups or whatever it is every morning. That's really important to him. He measures how many sit-ups he can do, and that's part of his self-worth. It's totally that principle. It's a kind of late capitalist phenomenon. It's called scientism, the belief that everything can be measured.
Okay.
And as a result, for students, for example, they end up measuring themselves through numbers, number of hours you do in the library, the marks you get, the amount of money that you might make after university.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. Could you talk briefly about how suicide has affected you and others around you?
Yeah, so the first time that I encountered suicide, or indeed anything relating to depression as far as I knew, was when I was 18. And a friend of mine at school in my year kills himself very, very suddenly.
Mm-hmm.
And none of us knew that this would happen. This boy was one of the best people that I could explain to you. He was incredibly good looking. He was incredibly popular. He was a lovely guy inside and out. I couldn't have thought of a bad word to say about him. He was an amazing sportsman as well and very intelligent. I mean, I'd almost be tempted to say that if I was going to describe the perfect person, it would have been him. And then one day we were told that he had he'd killed himself, and that was a real shock on several levels. Obviously, this was the first person my age I'd known to have died.
Yeah.
So there was that shock, but then it was also just the idea that this boy had been suffering in such a profound way, and none of us knew it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And you would never have known. I was in a politics class with him, and he was just as chirpy and intelligent and willing to contribute as anyone else. So that was the first time that I really thought, hold on, there's something. Well, what is depression? What is this thing? I'd never come across it before, and it can do that to someone. And then since then, well, in the last 6 months, 5 months, I should say, three of my friends have died, and two of them were from suicide. One of whom was a very close friend of mine when I was at school. So again, another one from that year in school. And again, I didn't know that he was depressed, which is slightly more disturbing for me than the boy who died when I was 18, because I knew this guy better.
Yeah.
I knew him really well. I had no idea.
No idea at all.
Not a clue. No.
And absolutely terrifying.
A very good friend of mine saw him actually the day that he died and said that he was on great form, as far as he was concerned.
So it's sort of like a mass depression that's manifesting itself under the surface and it's not necessarily detectable by loved ones or friends. Mm. On that note, would you say that the university is doing enough to help? Is there enough support? Or is it impossible, as you say, to spot these problems and therefore not necessarily that easy to provide the help that people need?
It's an incredibly difficult thing to have to deal with. The university isn't doing enough. Mm-hmm. Part of the reason is because they don't have enough money for it. Part of the reason is because the rise in demand has surged in the last couple of years and they weren't ready for that. But it's also incredibly difficult to set up mental health services in an institution such as the University of Bristol, because you don't have... Well, say other universities, for example, Oxford, Cambridge, Durham have got a collegiate system. So you've got colleges and these very centralised social places where it's easier to keep an eye on people. You can have someone in every hall's block or whatever looking after the students. Whereas somewhere like Bristol, you are at home, and then if you have a contact hour, you'll go into uni for that.
And you spend an awful lot of time on your own, don't you?
Spend an awful lot of time on your own. And that's definitely been my experience as an English student, is feeling quite disconnected, actually. Mm-hmm. And I feel lonely very, very easily here. And I think that's a very, very normal
common
thing.
Problem. Mm. I would agree. And how would you say that suicides have affected you and the people around you, in the sense of, is there a mood that then goes on and pervades the university afterwards, word gets out?
It's definitely been an important issue for a lot of students in the last few months. I think, in my experience, what it has changed is people's reaction to the phrase mental health,
mm-hmm.
Which isn't... I actually sometimes have a bit of an issue with that terminology. Describing something as mental health can be quite reductive, but it's also... There's a reason that we use it, and it is useful. So when you say to someone, I'm worried about my mental health in this respect, certainly recently people have been... you know, putting their phone down and looking at you and saying, actually, maybe this is more important than I thought it was.
So do you think people are starting to talk about it in the way that they need to?
They certainly are. Yeah, definitely. And I'm delighted that that's the case.
Yeah.
Because the really important thing about that is getting people who might be concerned about their health
mm-hmm.
to tell people.
Yeah.
It's finding the right opportunity to bring it up. I think that's very difficult for a lot of people.
And I have one final question, which is sort of financially orientated. Do you think that lowering the cost of tuition fees would improve students' mental health by relieving some of the financial pressures that students face today?
Yes, 100%. There's absolutely no question about that. I really think that the imposition of tuition fees was an absolute disgrace for a lot of different reasons.
Yeah.
It was an ideological move rather than a practical one. And what it did is it shifted this enormous burden of debt onto young people who basically were told that if you want to learn and if you want to go somewhere in life in a particular way, then you're basically being punished for it. And what you've got to understand about debt is that debt is a form of control. So when the government puts you in debt to themselves, they're basically saying, you are under our thumb. You can't do anything that will leave you unable to pay. So you've mm-hmm. got to go and get a certain kind of job.
And do you think there's like a locked-in syndrome that people feel when they get to university? So the minute they arrive, they're signed up to pay this huge debt that is then over their head for the next 3 years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. I think people really struggle with that because they think, on top of all the normal pressures, I mean, and you've got to remember that the mental health crisis, as I said earlier, is happening for lots of different reasons. Things like the breakdown of family, things like... the lack of good employment, the lack of housing, the lack of decent wages, all that kind of stuff. That on top of all that, that these students are then feeling as if they're trapped by the amount of debt that they're in.
Yeah.
That could be a big explanatory factor to mm-hmm. what's going on, I think, yeah.
Okay, well, that's definitely a lot of food for thought. Thank you for coming in today, Benji.
No worries. Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you.
That's all for this week, Dialects Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast. If you're online, you can subscribe to our emails and download the podcast the week before broadcast at dialectradio1word.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, that is James and Hubert Sadej, both homeless in Bristol, both having a difficult time in different ways. Also Charles Shi, the whistleblower from China. And Imogen Sawatka with Benji Beer, you just heard there. And our studio engineer, Dave Bazanko. Dialects of Bristol Broadband Co-op production. Catch us on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon, and anyone can contribute. Contact us through the People's Republic of Stokescroft, just off Jamaica Street, on 0117 909 6897. Their website's prsc.org.uk. Or you can go to the national volunteering website, do-it.org. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week. Goodbye for now. Thank you.
Aquarius. Libra. Leo. Cancer.
Ralph.
Charles. Paul. Larry.
Now I like a woman who loves her freedom, and I like a woman who can hold her own. And if you fit that description, baby, come with me. Take my hand. Come with me, baby. You love me. Let me show you.
And my name is Larry. And I like a woman that loves everything and everybody. Because I love everybody and everything. And you know what, ladies? If you feel that this is you, then this is what I want you to do.